This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Today I'm with Dr. David Kipping from the Harvard-Smithsonian Centre for Astrophysics. Hi, David.
Hello.
Thanks for being with us. David's centre of interest is a topic that we've touched upon in the Jodcast, especially in our odds and ends segments, quite a bit, and it's exomoons, or exoplanets, and specifically exomoons. So to start things off, could you just give us an outline of what your research involves and how you detect and look for these exomoons?
Sure. So we're looking for these moons, which are around planets outside the solar system, exomoons. And the way we look for these things is basically by the most popular method, which is being used to find planets these days, and that's the transit method. So this is when you have a planet which has its alignment just at the right inclination, such that you happen to see it pass in front of its host star once every orbital period. So for the Earth and the Sun, that would happen once every 365 days if you're an alien looking at the solar system. But the alien would also see just before or just afterwards a little tiny extra dip in brightness. So you get one dip in brightness as the planet casts a shadow basically on the face of the star, and then another little dip in brightness either just before or just afterwards due to the little moon, which is a companion to it. So essentially we're scouring through all of this beautiful photometry collected by the NASA Kepler space mission and trying to find these little extra dips just to the sides of the main transit events.
How do you know, how does Kepler know where to start off? Do you just choose random stars and point your telescope at a star and think, with any luck, there'll be an exoplanet here and we might be able to see it? How does the selection process work?
There is method to the madness. It's not, we don't just randomly point. Probably a big work if we did that. Actually, what we do is, first of all, we know only a fraction of Kepler's stars. It looks at 200,000 stars any one time. Actually, it's stopped looking right now. It's now moved to a different field in its second phase of its mission. But originally, it was looking at 200,000 stars. And of those 200,000, it found about 4,000 Kepler planetary candidates. So it couldn't confirm absolutely every single one was a genuine bona fide planet, but it saw 4,000 dips, which looked like there were planets. So first off, we have those 4,000 objects, which are probably much more worthwhile to look at than just a random star. And then, of course, 4,000 is still a very big number. It's a big work to look through 4,000 planets. So then we down-select on those. And essentially what we want is a planet which is far enough away from its host star, such that it could hold onto a moon. And you can see that if you look at the solar system, the Earth and all the planets beyond the Earth going out into the solar system have moons, whereas Venus and Mercury, which are closer to the Sun, do not. So as you get closer to a star, the gravitational influence of the star starts to rip off moons. So you want a planet which is fairly far out. And second of all, you want a planet which is not too small. You want a planet which is Neptune size or Jupiter size. And then it has a much better chance of holding onto a moon for a long period of time by virtue of its stronger gravity. So we tend to make our target selection based on those criteria.
Finding an exoplanet in itself is a pretty difficult task, and the dip in the light must be absolutely tiny because stars are just so much bigger than their planets. So how do you make sure that the dip is definitely due to a planet and then a moon and not just something else or something from problem with the telescope?
Yeah, so what happens with a normal planet signal, and again, you can think about this with the Earth around the Sun, every 365 days, you see the Earth go in front of the star, and it's like clockwork. Every single 365 days, you see the same event, the same shape, the same depth. It looks exactly the same. But then to the left or to the right of it, you see a signal which seems to be sort of random. It's either sometimes it's over to the left, sometimes it's over to the right, and it's clearly not following that same clockwork cycle. And the reason is because it's kind of following a clockwork all of its own. Instead of orbiting the star, it's going around the planet. And by seeing where those events are, you can actually potentially work out what is the orbital period of the moon going around that planet. So what we do is we look at the timings, basically. The planet should be like once every year, once every 365 days, or whatever the orbital period is. Whereas the moon will sort of look random when you first look at the data. But when you do a more detailed sort of dynamical analysis, you realize it's not random. There is a pattern to those shifts.
So the big question, have you found any convincing exomoons?
Not yet. We've been scouring the Kepler data for about a year and a half, 2 years now. And the first problem we had some teething problems doing a project like this, as is always the case. And the teething problem we had is that this requires really big computers. And the reason is because you're basically simulating a mini solar system on a computer, which takes a lot of time to sort of dynamically evolve all of these motions. And then on top of that, Kepler has collected many hundreds of thousands of data points, and every single data point we need to simulate these events. So it's over the last 2 years, because of these constraints, we've got through about 20 planets. So we've looked at 20 planets in detail, and we can say in those 20 planets, there's no moon there. And we can say in about 1 in 3 cases, there are no moons there which have the same ratio as Pluto does to Charon. That's Pluto's moon. Mm-hmm. And in 1 in 6 cases, we can rule out Earth-Moon mass ratios. So that's about a 1% mass ratio. The moon is about 1% the mass of the Earth. Right. So even with Kepler data, which is a mission, I should say, not designed to find exomoons, we've been able to use it to say that in some cases we can tell there is definitely not a moon of the same mass ratio as the Earth-Moon system. Of course, what we're hoping for is to get a positive detection. You know, mm-hmm. a null detection is great, and it's great to get these upper limits.
Sure.
But what we really want to do is find a genuine moon system. And we're hoping that in the next year or two, we should find them, because everything we've learned about exoplanets finds that it's capable of building any kind of system you can kind of imagine. It's mm-hmm. extremely imaginative, and nature can build anything.
Right.
So what we're hoping is that the Earth-Moon system is not a fluke, and there are things like that out there. And if there are, we should find them in the next year or two. It's really work that we're gonna grab by sort of 2015, 2016. We should have found a moon by that point.
So it's pretty much just a numbers game at this point, where you're thinking there has to be some sort of moon visible to us in the data that we have already.
Yeah, in fact, it would be kind of disappointing, but also remarkable if we didn't find anything. It would increase our sort of special place in the universe mm-hmm. if. Not only is the Earth at just the right distance from its star to have liquid water, it's just the right size, has all of these Goldilocks conditions, but what if also our moon is incredibly unique and no other planets out there in the universe have moons like ours? So I think obviously it'd be disappointing if we didn't find anything, but there's actually a remarkable consequence of not finding anything at all.
Going back to something you said before, so Kepler isn't really designed for finding exomoons, but I mean, this is presumably the first time that people even looked for exomoons in this sort of data. I mean, it wouldn't have been possible with previous telescopes.
Yeah.
I guess if you find one, there's going to be a groundswell of support for more exomoon finding missions.
I would have thought so. I mean, 20 years ago, we'd never found an exoplanet before. There were people who were working on it, such as Jeff Marcy, and they tell these stories that when they told colleagues and friends they were looking for planets outside the solar system, their colleagues would sort of put their heads down and look uncomfortable around them and sort of, you know, almost feel embarrassed for them for having this crazy idea of looking for planets outside the solar system. And now it's like, how could you not have realized there was so many planets out there? And why wasn't everyone trying to do that? And of course, it's people jump on the bandwagon once the detection's been made. I guess probably the same thing's going to happen if we get lucky and we find an exomoon, that this whole field will explode. And I guess that we're going to open up a door into an entirely new type of astronomical object. We have stars we can look at, we have galaxies we can look at, we have planets we can look at, mm-hmm. and we'll add on an extra category, which will be moons outside the solar system, which we can look at. So it'll be an entirely new subfield, I think, of scientific endeavor to study these things. So there's a huge potential, but it's challenging to get to that first one, to cross that threshold.
Actually, I had another question in my mind. I think a lot of our listeners will be wondering, because we talk about these things all the time, but how far away is the sort of average exoplanet or exomoon system? Like,
all of the stars which the Kepler mission looks at are actually pretty far away. We're talking about 1,000, 2,000 light years away. And that's because its observing strategy is what's called sort of a deep field mode. It stares at one patch of the sky continuously. And if you just take one patch of the sky, then there's probably not going to be many stars in the foreground. So the way it gets up to that huge number of 200,000 stars is by looking very deep into space, very far away. By doing that, it's able to be very stable because it doesn't have to move. It just points at that same patch of the sky continuously. And that was very easy technologically to build an instrument which didn't have to move around too much. Now, of course, that's great, but what we want to do is find planets nearer to, mm-hmm. to Earth, nearer to home. So maybe we could go on a vacation there in the near future. And one of the missions coming up, actually two missions coming up, one is NASA's test mission, which will be a similar design to Kepler, but it will be slightly smaller, yet looking at stars closer, so it doesn't have to be as big as Kepler. And it will have this very complicated pointing mode where it will basically look at every single part of the sky over its two-year mission.
Okay.
So it'll be looking at all over the sky and finding planets much, much closer to home. These will be planets which will be sort of anywhere from 20 light years up to sort of 500 light years. Planets much closer to home, planets which you might even think about sending a probe to one day. Right. And again, Plato, which is the European mission, which was also recently selected, that'll be flying about 5 years later. So we have TESS in 2018 and Plato in 2024. And these missions are both designed to find the nearest planets to home and maybe even the nearest exomoons to home as well.
Nice. Yeah, that's really, really exciting. Well, given the example of our own solar system, I reckon the different moons of the planets on our solar system are probably the most exciting places. You get places like Europa with the ice. And in the same way of thinking, exomoons will probably have maybe more potential to harbor life than exoplanets, because a lot of the ones, the exoplanets we're seeing are all these sort of big, like Jupiter-like planets or gassy giants, and because they're the bigger ones and they're the ones we can see right now. So. Yeah. Would there be any way of studying exomoons in as much detail as we have exoplanets?
Well, I think you touched on a really interesting point there, and that's, you know, moons could be habitable. We don't know of anywhere in the universe right now that's habitable apart from the Earth, unfortunately. We're looking very closely at Mars. We're sending, obviously, rovers there right now to try and dig up soil. And we know of moons, as you say, like Europa, which maybe could also have life as well. The beauty of moons in terms of habitability is that they can have habitable conditions much further away from their star than a planet could. So if you think about the Earth, if I moved Earth all the way to where Jupiter is, much further away from the host star, it would freeze and there'd be no heat source. It would just be a ball of ice. Now, if you take Europa around Jupiter or any of the Galilean satellites, yes, they have a cold surface, but underneath that, we think there's actually a liquid ocean. And that liquid ocean is being heated by internal energy from inside the moon. And that internal energy is basically Jupiter's gravity. So when you're a moon going around a planet, you can actually receive extra heating. It's called tidal heating. So the same thing which causes the waves on our planet due to the moon, the tides, that same energy is kind of put on steroids when you become a moon around a planet like Jupiter. And that same energy can deposit so much heat that it could basically give you sort of conditions almost like in Iceland, where you have these kind of icy springs where hot water bubbles up, and that's where you might find life. So I think moons have an enormous potential, a very diverse range of habitable conditions which could be present.
That's amazing. Well, I guess that the telescopes will have to be even more sort of powerful to be able to detect things like atmospheres or different sort of reflectivities to figure out what's going on the surface, though, before we send any probes.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we're hopefully going to have that with the James Webb Space Telescope in, I think that's about 2018 as well. And this will be a mission which is going to do a diverse range of things from cosmology to galaxy formation. But one of its big components will be to try to measure, smell the atmospheres of planets far away, and maybe even detect the biosignatures that life reveals in the atmosphere. So the future is very bright. James Webb is going to be a big step towards finding biomarkers. And if anything, I just would hope for more missions like that. We have several, many planet hunting missions, but only really this one planet smelling mission, if you like, just James Webb's Space Telescope. Sure. So I'd like to have more missions maybe in the future that could actually characterize these worlds in more detail. And then we'll be all set. Just send a probe.
Yeah, exactly. So we're that much closer. Well, Jodcasters, you heard it here first. The science of exomoons is alive and well. Thanks a lot for talking to us today, David.
Thank you for having me.